After years of bemoaning housing affordability, we've reached a boiling point in the U.S. Mortgage rates hover stubbornly above 6%, and 47% of first-time homebuyers report that they must spend more than they planned, draining savings just to get a key in hand. At the same time, nearly a quarter of builders' new home construction budgets are reportedly absorbed by regulatory red tape before even breaking ground, while Blackstone's build-to-rent machine is just beginning doubling rents and locking up entire neighborhoods. Add to that the, quote, golden handcuff effect, where 4 out of 5 existing mortgages sit below 5%, freezing owners in place and strangling supply. Fannie Mae actually warns that the lock-in and affordability squeeze will define 2025, with rates unlikely to budge. Yet still, investors snapped up nearly 17% of homes last year, and smaller rental property owners now shape 1/4 of all sales. In short, the American dream is being renegotiated in real time. Who builds, who buys, and who simply rents forever?
So the argument, to your point, is null and void because we're not building the right homes. We're not providing affordability for the right people. And if we were to lower rates, we're lowering rates for everybody. First-time homebuyers will get steamrolled by the investors and people that have the money already. And even if we were to build so many affordable homes, and they're big and beautiful and incredible, investors are just going to buy them. We're not doing anything to stop that.
That was my guest, real estate agent Zachary Frost. I'm Demetrius Lynch, and this is Spaces, the podcast where we explore the forces that shape our spaces and how they shape us. Thanks for coming back, everybody. Today's guest, Army Vet, Delaware real estate agent and owner of Loft Realty, and TikTok phenom with nearly 2 million followers, doesn't mince words about the market. From 2% pandemic mortgages to build-to-rent suburbs, Zach explains how middle-class families are being squeezed by regulatory costs, investor cash, and a chronic shortage of affordable homes. This conversation is the perfect preview of my next limited series season, where I'll trace the evolution of housing and affordability, dissect the power players who inflated prices, and explore solutions. Enjoy Zach's candor now, then make sure to subscribe so you won't miss the full story this fall. Today, Zach breaks down why a 110K salary can't snag a starter condo, how 25% of every new build is swallowed by fees, what first-time buyers might try while rates hover near 7%, policy solutions, and so much more. And we'll get into all of that after this break. Hi, Demetrius here. As you may know, Spaces is part of Gable Media, the next evolution of interactive media and resources for the AEC community and beyond. You may have heard me previously mention the development of a brand new membership platform for Gable Media. Well, it's finally here. You can now sign up to be a member at gablemedia.com/members. And as your first major perk, you gain exclusive access to our continuing education program, including AIA creditworthy courses. That's right. Gable Media is now an official AIA CES provider, and you can get credit for listening to Select Spaces episodes. The days of scouring the internet for online courses and running around town for creditworthy presentations are over. I've tried out our program, and it is the most convenient way to get your continuing education credits. Now, this membership tier will be limited, so make sure to go to gablemedia.com/members or just click the link in the show notes to gain access today. Thank you for joining me. I was just telling you, doing some research, I stumbled upon your Instagram feed. You have a lot of high energy, super informative, powerful reels that I just could not stay away. And I had to DM you. I was like, get on my podcast. Zach, thank you for joining me.
Demetrius, thanks for setting up the place. This is a cool setup. And
I love the messaging of your podcast and what you're focusing on. I'm really looking forward to this conversation. But yeah, dude, there's a lot to be energetic about. There's a lot going on. You can look at the debt. You can look at the deficit. You can look at declines. You can look at all the D's you'd like. There's a lot of things to look at. And I'm looking forward to this inner workings conversation specifically around housing, man.
Zach, to start, tell me a little bit about yourself, what you do, and how you got to where you are today.
Well, it's a convoluted journey. I'll warn you up front. So started in the military. I was born and bred military brat, Georgia, Texas, and then Delaware. My parents got locked in Delaware. And from there, I joined the Army, went overseas, did Georgia, El Paso, and got back to Delaware. From there, I went into the law enforcement route. I didn't do anything sales, anything financial, and I doubled down with college. And I will say the last time I was on a college campus, I was two semesters in on my associates for business administration, and I was being escorted out by security. People have asked me before, what's your major in? I'd be like, I'm majoring in nothing. I just got a real estate license. I got a high school degree and 99-hour online course, baby, and no felonies. But I had a friend of mine when I was working in the prison system. I often say that I became a realtor for the first time while in prison. It usually embarks us on a fun journey. But I was on the right side of the bars. But that's where I got started. I was signed up via a little bit of entrepreneurial bullying from someone who's like, why are you a prison officer? You should be doing something a little bit more relational, charismatic. And that lined up with my issues at the prison, because the biggest issues I ever had with my leadership was I was talking too much sports with the inmates. I wasn't on paper the greatest prison officer, but all that to the side, studied the market, learned as much as I could, ended up going full-time about 5 months after passing the course. And since then, started selling homes in Delaware, made a team, got blessed. The timing of getting started, which of course, anybody paying attention to the housing market, I'm sure we'll touch on. You know, I got started January 2017, studying in 2016, leaps and bounds different from where we sit in 2025. And I think that realization really started to hit me. And that leads us to today. In summer of 2023, rates had been brought back to record pace of increasing, not the highest rates we've ever seen, but in comparison to home prices, pound for pound, began to get really unaffordable. And so my messaging began to shift little by little. At first, I felt like I was yelling into a wall, like no one was listening. I was like, guys, I just talked to someone who makes 110K and I can't get them into a house. Why is this shouldn't be happening? And all the comments were like, well, their debt's probably too high and they need to get rid of their credit cards. I'm like, maybe, but normally it doesn't matter what you did wrong. As long as you made 110K, I can get you in the house. And as you know, and as probably many of, like you said, you have a very smart audience base. He was, anybody listening, he was gloating on you earlier saying how smart the audience base is. The high IQ listeners know we've been in this scenario now for a couple years. There's some solutions out there. They're kind of wishy-washy, but ultimately I found myself as a creator for at least bringing awareness to what we're currently going through. And if I can be a part of the change or at least bring awareness to some potential solutions to those problems, that's the reason for the yelling in the front seat of my car.
God, I love that. I want to start in one particular area that has always confounded me. And I'm curious if you have an answer. A lot of the developers, builders that are not a lot, I'll say a couple that I've run across say that housing affordability or the lack of affordability is purely a cause of codes that are requiring advanced energy specifications and different things about, for us in California, approaching net zero, all those sorts of things. And that's the only reason why we have a problem with housing affordability. Do you find that to be accurate? Not accurate? Half yes, half no.
Let's look at the two things that cause unaffordability. It's a great, I hear you. That's a great, what I would say, piece or spoke on the wheel of unaffordability. Because the two things that immediately come to mind are land developers being held back. This can go back to zoning, tax codes, redlining, you can go a lot of different directions with that. Different bills that keep or prevent vertical building, multifamily building in certain areas. We'll put that to the side. The second one would be regulatory costs. Regulatory costs, environmental studies being a big part, have to be paid by these big land developers. And a lot of people don't know this. 25% it's 24.8. 24.8% of a build's cost is in regulatory costs. And one of the big ones is environmental studying, is infrastructural upkeep, schools, sewer, water, electric, the grid, and permits, fees, inspections. Then you got to buy the land. If you haven't already bought the land, you probably already bought the land. But my point being, the cost of dirt today and the cost of getting through the dirty and muckiness of local boards, you're normally in over 50% of your end sales price of a unit before you've ordered a shingle or hired a worker. So yeah, I absolutely believe that's a spoke in the wheel, because we're adding to the cost for builders to bring product. Now, another argument I've heard to that is, just to play devil's advocate, we've seen costs go up, but we've also seen record profits for most builders who are paying those fees. Mm-hmm. So I don't like to blame it squarely on the progressive movement of making sure, you know, we're protecting our environment, we're doing things the right way, and we're utilizing the land that we've been given properly. I got no quarrels with that. I do have quarrels with the cost of getting the product to the consumer. And I also have quarrels with the lack of regulation around when the expense is lowered, that cost push inflation doesn't unravel.
Unpack that a little bit.
So cost push inflation, the two different types of inflation we can walk into with any product, service, or good is cost push or demand pull. Demand pull is when people want more of something than what exists. That's pretty standard supply and demand. And cost push is when the cost to bring it to market is more expensive than it had been. So perfect example would be COVID. We kind of went through a little bit of both, where the demand for housing skyrocketed, and yet people weren't selling because they didn't want this ugly, stupid green virus walking through their house, right? But all these people had 2% pre-approvals. So what are we going to do? And I remember being an agent. I remember getting the list of mandatory jobs or jobs that were allowed to continue, and agents weren't on it. But yet my lines were blowing up. Like, I want to go see this. I want to go see it. I'm like, okay. I'm like, am I going to get arrested? And there were a lot of agents, actually. We took fire during that time, because there was a lot of agents who were like, oh, I'll wait until this blows over. It's only going to be 2 weeks. Well, 2 years later, we shifted our entire system. We were very virtually focused. We did so much of our meeting ahead of time, prior to actually meeting, so we could get to business when we're in person and not have to like breathe on each other. So that cost push, a lot of people that wanted a little bit of what was available, housing, multiple offers, 30 showings per, huge open houses, got kind of smacked in the face at the same time with cost push. Steel was more expensive. Wood got more expensive. Most expensive it had ever been by 1,000-foot board for a time. You can look up Tradenomics, Fed Reserve, all the data's there. And all these other mucky things with supply, demand, logistics of getting the home built up, it became this 47% skyrocketing of value. So I don't think that, and here's where I get back to our original talk, is if we were to remove, which is one big thing that Donald Trump wants to do with his term, I'm neither red nor blue, I just want to chase green. If Donald is actually able to take away or lower, as he stated, slash, I think are his exact words, regulatory costs for builders, I'm not necessarily convinced that cost push inflation will untether itself, will just unravel. That builders would be like, oh, it's cheaper for us to build. Let's give that to the consumer. You know, we haven't had evidence of that in the past. When things got more expensive, we also get simultaneous reports of record profits. And that's not just housing. It's pretty much everything. So I guess I'm just a pessimist that we're going to see the money come back to us.
Yeah, that's not how business works.
It's a lot of times not how the macro corporate leaning capitalism neoliberal system we've created leans. No.
Yeah. Once you get to a certain price point, you don't go backwards unless you absolutely have to.
Especially if people are buying it. Now, again, that would be, and we could go back and forth with both sides and multiple different micro arguments on these takes. And my comment sections, if you ever want to read them, have plenty of them. So I get lots of practice. The other argument is, well, Zach, people aren't buying new construction right now. It's starting to sit. So if they do get the ability to do it cheaper, they probably would because they're not selling. I think there's room for that argument. But then I also think to another part, and I don't want to get ahead. I know you have questions that we want to talk about specifically, but now we're getting into the point of, are the homes we are building the homes that we need built? Or are we just building 4-bed, 2.5 bath, 3,000 square foot McMansions that aren't needed in this first time home buyer vacant society right now? We just don't have first time buyers that can actually afford homes because there aren't really homes that they can buy.
Yeah. So I want to get back to that, but I know you've done some research and kind of analysis. Where did things kind of get off the rails for us on this affordability?
COVID.
Oh, you think that recent?
So there's three markers I kind of put on our timeline. So home prices, yes, COVID. There's really nothing else we could look at other than the mixture of those two types of inflation just superpowering themselves like Chemical X for the Powerpuff Girls right in front of us. And the other two, I would say, is when we detethered ourselves or got away from being a free market, which was bailouts of 2008. We decided to go ahead and socialize losses, capitalize gains. I think right there was a huge moment. We also started there, QE, quantitative easing. That's a huge, huge, we don't have to get into that, variable into our current economy. And then the other, I would say, our policies that, man, we could go as back as far as you would like. Legislation, you know, we could look at 99 and the Glass-Steagall Act being taken away from 1933's legislation. We could look at 1944 to 71, the gold standards detethering. You could look at the petrodollar from 74 altering our economy. You could look at Reaganomics, which is a lot of people do, to save us from the savings and loan crisis and stagflation that we were walking to in the late 70s. There was a lot, when we look in our economic history, we quickly find there's a lot of knee-jerk reaction to temporary pain that leads to permanent repercussions. And I think we're currently living in one of those repercussions where there's too much money for a few people, not enough money for the majority of people. And the number one item to literally live, shelter, is more expensive than it's ever been and more inaccessible it's ever been. So I do, to your point, you're like, is that the only thing? No, I think it's combo. But as of recently, probably the easiest answer would be COVID. We saw corporate prices for everything go up, cost of living go up, steel, food, clothing, everything. And that affects somebody's ability to not be house poor. If somebody's walking into a home house poor, someone like myself, or I know many other ethical agents that are going to go into your finances and want to know, okay, if you're making $6,000 a month, how are you going to pay this $2,500 mortgage when your grocery bill and power bill are both going to be about, you know, $300 a pop? I want to make sure you're not going to be calling me in a year saying I got to sell and then you don't got equity and then we got bigger problems. So I don't think it's the only reason, no, but I think it's the most glaringly obvious spike. Because home prices since COVID have gone up 47% nationally, some larger in other areas. And even if we were to see a 10% correction, that's not going to hardly eat into what we've lost over the last 5 years.
I want to spend a few minutes in this affordability conundrum that we're in, or income inequality and the finances of society. And from the angle that we had a lot of reports of some of these big corporations colluding and setting prices, price fixing.
Hold on, let me get my tinfoil hat. It's over here.
Yeah. So, and some of them have actually been found guilty of it. So you have the driving up of, obviously everybody knows the eggs, but there are several other products that were driving up costs. Do you think that has been an element of this cost issue of things getting out of control and that being a contributor to our affordability problem as well, if that makes sense.
It does. I think there's two angles to the question. To break down what you said, make sure I'm understanding it. Is there colluding going on to price gouge? Yeah. Are we seeing macro corporate influence get together to say, hey, prices are up, we're going to keep them up. We're going to inwardly compete, but we're going to compete at this price. We're not going to go down. I think there's two angles to it. One, I think the mixture of colluding could more so be looked at as control rather than colluding. I think there's two items that are always at play: micro greed and macro power. The micro greed, I think, is every single company, every single entity, every single household that just wants to make a little bit more money. There's no one person listening to this podcast where I say, hey, if next year you made 20% more money, would that be okay? Okay, yeah, no one's going to say no to that. So everyone's trying to do that because that's what we've created, a world where you need that to survive, and more of it means your life's going to be easier, simpler, you can help other people, theoretically. Most people just run into more debt. But the macro power, I think, is more so where it comes from, these prices. Look at the stock market. Seeing as you pulled the tinfoil hat out, let's look at who owns a influential share of over 85% of every single S&P 500 company. Private equity. Specifically, companies like BlackRock, Vanguard, State Street, Street Corp. And they're winning. Why? Because their investments are going up, the assets they manage are going up. And a lot of people don't know this. Even things like the energy score that companies get for their how well they're doing in terms of green energy and everything, BlackRock helped create and authoritatively says we all need to use that. They're the ones that set the description pretty much of what the scoring system is used in. It's weird. And then you look at the way that they evaluate their companies. They own the valuators, and then they have to have an investigator come in, and they own the investigators. So I think it's a lot of macro power that's influencing it, because ultimately they're not affected. They can kind of see how long they can go before we're drained. Now, do I think we're getting closer to drain than maybe they think? Yeah. But no, I don't think price gouging is like Nike and Adidas and Reebok getting together saying we're going to up these costs. I think there was cost push inflation. I think consumer spending was still up since 2021's and 2022's money printing and stimulus checking. You can look at Fed Reserve accounts. You can look savings accounts, disposable income, even M2 money to see that there was more money flowing around. Now those numbers are way down, not M2, but you know what personal households have is way down, consumer spend, disposable income. So we may be getting to the point where the rewards have been ripped, and now we're kind of stuck in this scenario where you think, okay, does this lead to tokenization? Does this lead to worldwide or national central bank currencies? Does this lead to, you know, everyone's like, buy Bitcoin, buy gold? What does this lead to? Universal basic income is another one. I don't know. But what I would say is ultimately, yes, that the 0.1, even the 0.01% of wealth has benefited largely off of what it's created. And it's not going to just say, okay, I want to make less money now. That's never been, no one's ever said they wanted to make less money or have less power. So those things, detethering, wealth redistributing naturally, power disseminating out naturally, it doesn't happen. It happens by force, bill, or violence. And I don't really want the last one. I have a pretty nice life and my watermelons are still growing. I don't have time for pitchforks and torches. But I think there are a lot of people that are getting to that, especially the Gen Z generation, that sees what used to be a scalable obstacle now is just a flat facing wall with no ladder. And they don't know how to scale it. They're being told it's scalable by the same generation that doesn't have to pay healthcare, that doesn't have to worry about the job market, that doesn't have to buy a new home or new car, doesn't have childcare. They're over 65, aren't paying school taxes. There's so many different economic variables that they are not affected by that are leading them to say, oh, well, you know, everything goes in cycles. You'll get yours. Pick yourself up by the bootstraps. And we're like, yo, I got like 8 boots and tons of straps. Nothing's working. Like, what do I do? I think colluding is probably the wrong word. I think it's just a natural result of what we've created. We favor macro corporate capitalism, and they're continuing to keep their power and money flowing. And let's look at another thing, too. We don't monitor or enforce antitrust laws, monopoly law. We don't enforce it. Look at Citigroup. They basically are bigger than when they were broken up last. You look at AT&T and communications. They're humongous. The monopolistic activities of not only big banks, but also private equity hasn't been touched since we put laws in place in 2004 and 2010 and 2016 to give them higher margin breaks on what they can invest in, more risky investing, basically, and more capital investments. I think it was Citizens United were unlimited campaign contributions. I mean, there's so many things we could go into. I just think it all comes down to money, power. No one wants less of either. And they're going to continue to just do this until we can't consumer spend anymore, I guess.
Yeah.
It's kind of a bleak way of looking at it, but.
Yeah. Now, all of that perfectly leads me into, I want to take us back to kind of where you started. Kind of where you started in the COVID era, driving up costs. I think a part of that was that astronomically low interest rate of, what did it hit, 2%, 2.5?
I have a couple clients that even got into the high ones with paying down a little bit. But yeah,
wow.
Fed rate at 0% and mortgages in the twos and threes for about 2 years.
Wow. Now, we know that there's a lot of stagnation in movement of home ownership right now. People are not leaving their current home because they still have it at that 2% rate. Can you talk a little bit how that has affected? Because on two parts. One, that cheap money allowed a lot of these private equity companies to drive the costs up of the house to some crazy rate, right? Or some crazy amount for those homes because you had this 2% interest rate. So you can manage that monthly payment for a much bigger or much more expensive home. Can you talk a little bit about that? Am I off base or what are your, what's
your
take?
No, there's a lot to unpack there. There's two main things I'm hearing. So rates through COVID, and are people sitting on those low rates part of the problem today? People that can't move, and private equity purchasing properties. So let's start here, private equity purchasing properties. So private equity actually doesn't purchase as many properties as we're led to believe. So one thing that private equity actually does is A, they pretty much own the entire home creation, lending, insuring, and titling process. They have share in Bank of America. They have share in Allstate, State Farm, D.R. Horton, KB Homes, Kahov Nanny, and Berkshire Hathaway. They own the process of the home. The other thing, even though they do purchase properties, Atlanta, I believe it's 4.4%, Las Vegas, about 4.2%, Denver, Boston, there's areas of hotspots. But in large part, that's still kind of a small number in retrospect. Now, I believe the number should be zero. I believe the number should be zero on purchases from institutional investors, and that our LLC system is weird, allowing you to buy property indiscriminately and anonymously. I think it's weird. But that's the system we have. As of right now, private equity purchases about 1.8%, 1.6 to 1.8% of properties in America. Now, that's considered affordable properties, and an institutional investor is how I'm defining private equity, which is anybody who owns more than 1,000 properties. The biggest culprit is actually anybody who owns only 1 to 10 properties. That is the largest group of investor purchases. They purchased 19.6% of homes. I can speak to that. I have a list of over 150 now investors who want to invest in Southern Delaware that are waiting for rates to drop. They're on an alarm from me. 5.5%, go. And then automation sets them up to see more homes. Now, of course, there's not a lot available. But I can tell you right now, I got some investors that are just waiting with their mouths watering to get their hands on more properties. Now, there is some multifamily activity happening right now that may say that investors are starting to pull back a little bit, a lot to do with high rates. But ultimately, many are just waiting for it to drop. Many have big portfolio, got 8, got 12, got 20, are ready to add more. So I don't know if private equity is the biggest to blame there. Now, if we eliminated them completely, to go against my own argument, if we eliminated them completely from the last 5 years, we would have enough supply to have a healthy housing market right now, and we probably wouldn't be where we're at. Just to be very clear. Small percentage, but year after year after year after year, that percentage is getting eaten. And they focus specifically on multifamily housing, apartment housing sometimes, and affordable homes, townhomes, anything under 300,000. And they're building build-to-rent neighborhoods. Blackstone is now. Isn't that sick? Now, Blackstone's the nutty one. What they do with their money is they buy not individual properties often, as they buy companies that have portfolios of homes. So the numbers get a little skewed, because I tell you, oh, 1.6% of people at the closing table are actually institutional investors. That's not that much, Zach. But yeah, but they own Invitation Homes, who own over 80,000 properties. And they just bought them like that. 80,000 properties are theirs. That's kind of crazy. They own Tricon Residential. Tricon Residential's actively using the equity. It's crazy. And I don't have this on paper, but it seems this is exactly what's happening, that Blackstone's owns enough portfolio to get enough cash flow in that they've pretty much halted purchasing in lieu of putting their funds in the Tricon Residential, who are actively building build-to-rent neighborhoods. Now, if you're asking me, that says big money, smart money, they have access to everything money, is saying homeownership is probably not going to be as accessible as people want it to be in the future. Let's go ahead and get ready for that. Let's build rental neighborhoods, which is sick. Mm-hmm. Other side, are people holding onto their homes hurting the housing market? Yes. And for anyone listening is holding onto their home, no, I'm not accusing you directly. I have a home. I'm holding onto it. Now, I love my house. I wouldn't want to sell it. But I have that conversation, if not every day, multiple times a week. I want to sell my home. And then within 30 minutes, 45 minutes, we're to the point where they're not going to sell their home, because I've told them, well, where are you going to go next? Oh, well, we want to buy. Okay, great. Let's look at what your mortgage is going to be. And they're like, never mind. We're going to rent. We'll wait this out. Let me send you your rental options. There's three, and they're all twice as expensive as your current mortgage. I'm like, oh, well, what if we move somewhere else? Same problem. Okay, well, I don't have family or friends to live in with, so what do I do? And I tell you, there's two people that reach this point from firsthand experience almost daily. There's two people that reach this point. There's those that want to move, and there's those that have to move. Those that want to move don't move. Just being flat out, they don't. There's no option. It doesn't make sense. You're going to go live in a camper? Unless you're living in with family or friends and literally alleviating your monthly payment, it makes no fiscal sense. Or they have to move. Now, I have run into people who literally are struggling to pay their, and this is going to hurt some people's ears, $900 mortgage, $1,000 mortgage, and they can't sell it because they can't go somewhere else. So they're becoming landlords. These people who can hardly afford their low payments that have to move, they have to move for the military, or they have to move for a job, death, divorce, you're renting it. They get it in a will, and they're renting it. So these affordable homes aren't even making it to market. And this is one of the biggest reasons, in my opinion, housing can't crash. Supply. It's the number one needed metric for a price to die. High supply. We don't have it. And the supply we could have, 82% of it is currently locked in at a sub 5% mortgage. It's around 65, 67% of active mortgages have a 4% or sub mortgage. Why would that person sell? And the other big kicker, if that doesn't convince you enough, 39.7% of all homes in America don't even have a mortgage. What's going to kick them out of their home? High egg costs? No. Insurance? No. It's nothing. Nothing will kick them out of that house other than catastrophe, war, depression, detethering of the currency. We're talking something nobody in the middle class would want to be a part of, to get back to housing crash-like numbers, in my opinion. And I have that conversation all the time, because, of course, everyone wants the housing market to crash.
Yeah. Now, on that supply note, are we building the right product to replenish that supply?
It sounds like you already know the answer to the question. No, we're not. We're
we're not building what we need. What we need are smaller homes, just flat out. I had a conversation with someone the other day when we were talking about 1971. Now, let me pull this up real quick. I pulled up the wrong page. In 1971, I want you to take a stab at it real quick. What do you think the median cost of a home was?
1971, $79,000.
It was $24,500.
Oh my God.
So the median income at the time to be able to afford a home in that time was somewhere between 20 and 24K. As a household. But now it's $126,764. Now, a lot of people would say, well, two things. They built different homes back then. They were just cardboard boxes with windows and a door. That's all you got. And the second one is, well, what about inflated money, Zach? Is different now that it's inflated. Over here first. Yes, build smaller homes that are just cardboard boxes, 1,000 square feet with some windows. Stop building all these things that no one can afford. Start building tiny homes. Start building container neighborhoods. Why aren't we 3D printing housing? Why aren't we fixing our own problems with the tech that we have? Why has the construction process only gotten worse since the 40s and 50s and 60s and 70s? And yet we're pumping out more expensive homes that don't last as long that no one can afford. It doesn't make sense. So, A, build those homes. There's a lot of people that just want some dirt in a little square that they can call their own. They don't have to answer to a landlord and they can build some equity over time. Awesome. The other problem is we keep talking about, oh, well, the dollar is different these days. That's theft. where your dollar is worth so much less. And you're right. If you were to look at inflation for that time versus now, you basically, because what I said in a video the other day was you had to make $3.60 an hour to afford a home in 1971. And man. That just sent the boomers through the roof. They hated to hear that. And this, that, and the third. Well, this is this, and that is that. Well, if you were to account for inflation, it's about 10x. All right. Aside from whether or not that's theft, it's about 10x. So you have to make about $33 to $36 an hour today to match that buying power. But you need to make $56 to $58 an hour today to afford the same median home. So it hasn't kept up in nominal dollars or with real inflation included. So the argument, to your point, is null and void because we're not building the right homes. We're not providing affordability for the right people. And if we were to lower rates, we're lowering rates for everybody. First-time homebuyers will get steamrolled by the investors and people that have the money already. And even if we were to build so many affordable homes and they're big and beautiful and incredible, investors are just going to buy them. We're not doing anything to stop that. So it's this catch-22 that even if we did do it, and we are slightly seeing an increase in new construction builds, we are starting to see builder permits tweak up slightly, but we really need some momentum there, like a lot more momentum. We need to be building 2 million plus homes a year. We need to be building homes that are 1,000 square feet or less. We need to look into tiny home 3D printing. We need to look into the infrastructure and how the central bank monitors other banks and how they influence and ultimately encourage them to lend. We could encourage lending to more first-time homebuyer residential, I'm going to live in it people, than people with plans to profit on the property, but we don't. So there's only so much that we can do and talk about because there's a lot of people in a lot of rooms that make it happen that we don't have access to. But yes, the big problem, I believe, is in the product that we're building and the whole process that leads up to it. Because Demetrius, if you were to decide you wanted to go build a neighborhood tomorrow, you're not putting someone in one of those homes for about 2.5 years. Mm-hmm. We're not talking about a quick turnaround. So if you were to tell me right now with the last year and a half of even longer high rates, the last year and a half of corporate delinquencies increasing, the last year and a half of inflation continuing to reap its head, I don't think there's a lot of land development that's in the works right now.
Yeah.
I don't think there's a lot of innovative real estate ideas going on because everything's more expensive, even for the companies. So we're not building the right ones. And also, we probably don't have the right ones coming down the pipeline.
Yeah. But I do want to emphasize, I think a big part of that is that investor competition. When we were looking for our home, we bid on one house that was someone had died in it, hadn't been updated since like the 50s, and we went way over the asking price, and we still weren't in the top five of offers. You know, a lot of investor companies coming in, cash, all cash offers. So that is a big challenge as well.
And the market seeing basically two different types of listings, those that die, those that fly. There's the homes that are a little overpriced, not quite ready for that market, or up above the 500s, like in Delaware for us, like and think 200, 300K above your normal price in your area. A lot of those homes are beginning to sit. But if you put something up that's affordable, gone.
Yeah.
Gone. And you're right. Multiple offers, a lot of people with cash, a lot of investors, a lot of people that want secondary homes. They're downsizing from their own mortgage. Like, this is what I see. And this is probably the sickest one no one talks about, of uncle and aunt. The kids are out of the house. Not quite boomers, like Gen Xers, that are like, oh, I don't want this mortgage anymore. We have 300K in equity. We sell this. We could buy an affordable home in cash. Makes a lot of sense for them, but they're taking a home off the market that isn't for them, or at least wasn't originally planned for them.
Oh, that's such a great point, too.
It happens all the time in Delaware because people in Jersey, like Southern Jersey, you know, there's 12 counties in America, and that's probably going to go higher with recent tax increases, but there's only 12 counties in America that on average you're paying a $10,000 or more tax bill a year. It's only 12. Nine of them are in Southern Jersey. So there's so many people that want to get out, and there's so many people selling their very casual $780,000 home they bought for 300K. And then they bring their money down to Delaware and they get something near the beach and they go off and, you know, frolic in the fields until they die. Yeah. And they're never going to sell that affordable home. And the home they sold in Jersey is inaccessible for the other people. So what is the first time buyer to do?
Yeah. Zach, before we get out of here, you left a bunch of little nuggets along the way of solutions. What are the top three that you would say, 2 to 3 solutions that you would want to kind of impart on everyone of how to address this housing affordability issue from your perspective?
Hey, thank you for asking. I get on these podcasts sometimes and no one brings up solutions and it just ends up becoming a pity party of problems. Yeah. So I've written out quite a few solutions. And first, I'd like to define who can make them happen, because really we only have two parties. All right. We have two parties at the top, and then we could talk about state and local municipality because real estate's local. At the top, the Federal Reserve and our legislative branch can put together change. I'm going to focus first on this side. A, on the legislative side, we need to create simultaneously a first-time homebuyer fund and an investor ladder. What that is a fund that is created specifically and houses money only for funds for first-time homebuyers to either buy down their rates to be more competitive or use toward closing costs and down payment assistance. Most people need one or the other. A lot of people need help on the payment side. And if we lower rates, again, we're lowering them for everybody. So I think there needs to be something in place to where we can give some advantage to the first-time buyer. We fund it. So everyone's like, where's the money come from? With a investor ladder. Simply put, if you purchase a property with plans to profit, flip, invest, Airbnb, whatever, you're going to pay a 2 to 3% fee at the closing table that will go up as you invest more. It will simultaneously create a world where less people will invest when they have a lot more. And yes, you could create a corporate veil, an LLC, and blah, 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 blah. I think this would all come with, you need to fix that problem a little bit. But you're also going to create a world where minimum 2 to 3% comes out of every single time. You're going to quell a little bit of the demand there, a little bit less purchase because they're going to have to incur that fee. Also, could come off the purchase price because now investors are very money focused. They maybe say, hey, I have to pay this fee. I'm going to take it off the purchase price. That could happen. But you're ultimately going to create a take-a-home, make-a-home symbiotic relationship of if one home comes off the market for profit, there's another opportunity for a first-time homebuyer to purchase. Number one. Number two, let's go to the Federal Reserve camp. They only have two levers in their power. And if someone's listening to this, I'm familiar with our central bank, Federal Reserve. It was created in 1913 in the dead of night of December 31st on Christmas break. At a 42-27 vote with 25 senators not being present because they knew it wouldn't pass. And since then, it's been in operation and in charge of our monetary policy with two main tools. They can change rates and they can change money supply. They do that with quantitative tightening, quantitative easing, and they do it with the rates by the influence of the Fed rate, which largely has to do with investor sentiment, yields, bond auctions, a lot of complex. Ultimately, they affect the 10-year treasury yield, which leaks in the mortgage rates. So what we need to do there is leverage something that they've never leveraged. They have the ability, and I'll make it as layman as I can, to influence bank lending by having different reserve requirements on their capital based off where they're lending it. So to break that down, the Federal Reserve currently, do you know how much the Federal Reserve requires a bank to have on reserve with them if they're lending actively to us? Do you know how much they have to have?
No.
So in COVID times, it was about 10%, but since then it's been zero.
Wow.
0%, right? So in a world of fractional reserve lending or fractional lending already, now 0% reserve. So we need to bring that back, at least to 10%. But the other thing that we can do is we can say, hey, if you are lending to tech, if you are lending to education, if you're lending to corporate land development, you can create whatever world you want. You can basically state this to the Federal Reserve because you hold the regulation over all the main banks that you have to have a certain amount of reserve set aside for that specific genre of lending. So to get to the point, we can simply say, if you're lending to something that's going to assist the affordability of shelter, you're going to have a lower reserve requirement, less capital you have to have on hand in your bank in the form of capital equity. And if you were to lend to real estate investors, corporate investing in the big properties versus a construction loan that's going to be building $320,000 homes that are 1,000 square feet, different lending practice, which ultimately allows them the ability to give better deals, better incentives to the lendee, the person that's getting the money. So I think we could shift the way banks lend and give them better tools to help people. I think a lot of banks want to help, but they have to make a profit. And less people are getting on the debt train, less people are taking out credit. A lot of people's credit scores are in the tank because they're using their credit card to pay their electric bill and Karma-like pay later services for their groceries. I hate to smile at that, like it's atrocious, but we're in that world. That's what I think the Federal Reserve can do. I think they're kind of in a really weird bind where they're looking stagflation in the eye. And if they maneuver their, actually just did my solo podcast on this on my YouTube channel of the two levers they have at their disposal and what they can do. And really it's a lot of nothing because they're kind of in this stagflation point. So I think if we reshifted where they're actually doing things and where the money's lending. But the third one is more government. And to be frank with you, there's so much that could be done at this level. We could create term limits. We could create age limits. We could grandfather lobbying. We could get out, stock buybacks. We could get rid of corporate board positions for people. We could get rid of super PACs. Let's go down the line. At the core of it for housing, the one that I like the most is if we were to actually get into the weeds of how we bail out our economy when things get bad. The Toxic Asset Relief Program in 2008, I believe it was. It was either late 2007, 2008. Henry Paulson, you never heard this. This will baffle you. There's actually a full documentary on PBS Frontline called The Age of Easy Money. And in that interview, you get to hear people like Ken Lewis, who's at the time and still the president of Bank of America, talk about this secret meeting that was held for the allocation of TARP funds. Now, many people remember this for the bailing out of AIG, an insurance group. And we kind of made that deal profitable for us. Obama kind of shifted things up, made it okay. But the other side of about $130 billion was bailing out big banks. Most people have heard that. We bailed out banks. But do you know how exactly we bailed them out? We called them into DC, 11 big banks and their leaders, called them into DC, with 48 hours notice that be here Monday. And when if any of them asked who was going to be there or what was going to be talked about, they said, come here to find out. You're not going to be on the next call if you don't show up this time. You're going to get kicked out of the big boy club if you don't come this time. And then they came and did the secret meeting and they were told you're about to take taxpayer funds. You're going to take multiple billions of it and you're going to insert it into your top line accounts. And when asked, what do we need to do with the money? We don't care. Put it into your top line accounts. What's it going toward? We don't care. We need you to have good earning reports by Monday. And this is a quote from Henry Paulson, or we won't have an economy by the following Monday.
Wow.
So big, big move. But did it help the regular person? No, it didn't. We have a lot of studies that between that and the Dodd-Frank Act shortly thereafter, it really stifled the residential buyer. And it was the beginning uptick of institutional investing into real estate. So between that between the money printing and the Tax Cut and Jobs Act of 2017, between the bailouts that came from the end of Trump's administration and the beginning of Biden's. Again, I'm not blue and red. It is all about money and power. All the money that was printed, the $3 trillion that was added in both of those terms, and presumably another 3.8 that's about to get added via another tax cut, we continue to see money getting printed and go directly to the hands of banks. So I think we need to relook how we do bailouts. Why can't we bail out the housing industry? Why can't we put trillions into building the right homes? Why can't we put trillions into getting rates lowered for first-time buyers? Why can't we bail out the middle class for once in our lives? If we're going to continue to socialize our losses amongst the elite, at least let us get a little.
Yeah.
At least let us get a little. Because if we keep doing the same things, we're going to keep getting the same results. And that's consistently been inflation and inequality, especially in the wealth sector and the income sector. And I just think it's, as Einstein said, if you keep doing the same thing, expecting a different result, you're crazy. And I think our country is a little crazy for continuing to think that the canteen effect wouldn't reap its ugly head. And for those who don't know what that is, it's an early French economist who accidentally predicted the French Revolution that stated, when you're close to the money printer, you get richer. And a lot of us don't know where the money printer is.
Yeah. That is Zachary Faust. Zach, thank you so much. I'm going to have you back. There's no way you can't be back on the podcast. So,
I look forward to it, friend. I love the space you have created.
So for our listeners that want to find out more about you, what's the best way for them to follow?
Well, I happenstance my way into a following on TikTok. I just got on there to sell houses. And before I knew it, I was talking about national finance and the macro state of our economy and geopolitics. Didn't think I was going to be in that realm, but I am. And that's on TikTok at Zachary Loft. Same on Instagram. And over on YouTube, I'd encourage anyone who loves this podcast-like format to follow over on YouTube. That's where we're deep diving the current status of the Federal Reserve's options, what's actually going on in housing, and ultimately how we can unfold, understand, and act on what's going on.
Thank you so much, Zach. I'll make sure to put all the links in the show notes. And thank you to the listeners for listening. We will talk again on the next one. Thanks. Thanks for listening. Spaces is brought to you by Lines, my Southern California-based architecture and creative studio that provides services focused on custom homes, home renovations, creative office, and specialty retail spaces. Find out more at lines.studio. That's lines.studio. If you learned something from this episode or think it would resonate with a friend, please share it and rate and review the podcast on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. It really helps others find the show. If you have a question about the built environment or just want to share whatever is on your mind, I'd love to hear from you. You can do that at lines.studio/podcasts. Looking for similar content? Spaces is a proud member of Gable Media, a digital media platform where you can find even more content like this. Visit gablemedia.com, and that's gablemedia.com. And lastly, before I go, if you want to see additional photos, videos, clips, and other content from this episode, visit lines.studio/podcasts. Talk soon.